What if there were a fountain of youth pill that could add decades to your life? Would you take it? Unlocking the Fountain is a podcast about the mysteries of aging and the scientific quest to slow, stop, or even reverse it.
When do you think we're going to have the first 150-year-old? I think that person's already alive.
Unlocking the Fountain. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud. The president has been busy signing even more executive orders. As of this Monday morning, he has signed 42 of them, including an order to advance racial equity, expand healthcare. He's also come up with a more ambitious schedule for the COVID-19 vaccine rollout. And of course, there's that COVID relief bill to get through Congress. And looming in the background of all of this, Donald Trump's Senate impeachment trial hasn't even happened yet. We'll get into all of this today, and we'll take a closer look in the second half of the show at Biden's ambitious plans to address climate change. But to start, we are speaking with White House reporter for The Washington Post and CNN political analyst Sungmin Kim. You're listening to Party in the USA. Let's get started. Hello, Sungmin. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh, my pleasure. I am really relieved that you're joining me because there's so much news to make sense of, and I'm just grateful for your expertise.
Great, let's get right to it.
Let's do it. Okay, so we are recording this on Monday morning, and I want to touch base about a bunch of things. Let me start with the impeachment trial. So last week on the show, we made some predictions about how likely it was that some Republican senators may vote to convict Trump in that trial. The consensus was it's not likely. But since then, this new motion was put forward to dismiss the trial altogether, and all but five Senate Republicans voted in favor of that. We are a week away from the start of that trial. It's expected to start February 9th. But also over the weekend, basically the entire legal team for Donald Trump just quit. What should we make of that? How should we understand it?
What we should make of that is that anything with former President Trump is always in chaos. So you're right. Over the weekend, we had the surprise news that all five members, mostly based in South Carolina, all five members of the former president's legal team quit. And there's some reporting suggests that they quit because the president wanted to push them on the baseless voter fraud allegations that the former president had consistently espoused during the immediate weeks after his loss and continues to do so today. That seemed to be a pretty clear discord between the team. And as we speak, the president does have two new lawyers who will be defending President Trump in front of the Senate next week, but there's not a lot of time to prepare. I mean, we have not just the impeachment proceedings next week. Former President Trump is not expected to attend, but obviously the lawyers will have to be there and make their case, perhaps fight back against the argument that will come from the House impeachment managers that this is a constitutional impeachment, that we can expect that to kind of be the crux of the former president's legal team's defense. But there are a lot of things that you have to do before a trial to prepare. So tomorrow, on Tuesday morning, February 2nd, we expect the House impeachment managers to file their first official brief in the case that lays out in detail their arguments for essentially prosecuting former President Trump. And then next week on February 8th, the president's legal team has to file their own rebuttal brief. So there's a lot going on and not a lot of time to do it.
You know, I have to imagine that if we just quickly contrast this to former President Trump, gosh, I keep saying President Trump as though he's still in office. It still feels hard to believe that he's not. But in contrast to the last impeachment trial for former President Trump, the last one had a lot of digging through the bureaucracies, right? It had testimony from people who were based in Ukraine and all about U.S.-Ukraine relations. It had all this extraneous evidence. This is not that, right? This is a much sort of clearer narratives that the Democrats have to paint here. It's a simpler story to tell. So how are the Democrats preparing to tell the story that they want to tell?
They're basically trying to remind the senators who are the jurors here of what they lived through just on that horrifying day, January 6th, and show methodically through video images and through other testimony just how the president and his words and his actions incited those people who stormed the Capitol. So we've believe at the Washington Post have reported that they're putting together video images to make a compelling case that, yes, what the president said, not just immediately before the rally when he encouraged his supporters to go to the Capitol, not just that, but in the weeks before that, just how he methodically just spread this baseless lie that he had actually won the election despite all evidence to the contrary, that really fomented this belief among his supporters that he did win the election. They're trying to put together just how exactly his supporters were inspired by his words. So we can expect almost definitely video to be shown in that sense on the Senate floor during the trial proceedings. And they're just really trying to evoke that horror of January 6th and just show how the president caused it. And that's going to be a major part of the Democrats' arguments, the prosecution against him.
One of the stories that we're seeing is this really interesting thread where the man who was photographed wearing that face paint and the horn during the insurrection, he was known as the QAnon shaman.
Now Arizona's horned QAnon conspiracy theorist is facing federal prison time after what he calls just following orders.
We heard that his attorney is willing to testify that President Trump did, in fact, incite him. And that's an interesting dimension to me because it sort of brings the reality that is outside of the House into this trial, right? It sort of brings like the physical dimension of these are the people who were incited by the former president. Now they are in this trial, they're willing to say this is how his words impacted us. And like you were saying, there's this extra dimension of some of these senators would have lived through this. How do we think that changes the trial?
On the witness question, it's a really interesting one because the House impeachment managers haven't said one way or the other whether they will call or attempt to call witnesses to the Senate floor during the trial. That is something that could certainly, depending on who the witnesses are and what they say, certainly could make the difference in the minds of Republican senators who just may be on the fence of voting to convict former President Trump or not. But it is certainly something that's going to take more time, obviously, by calling witnesses, having the votes to allow witnesses in the first place, subpoenaing them if necessary. That is all time that, frankly, the Democrats, the most powerful Democrat of all, President Joe Biden, that is time that they do not want to spend on the president's impeachment trial. But ironically, it is something that could make the prosecution's argument more effective. So if I were a betting woman, I don't think we would see witnesses this time around. The House impeachment managers haven't telegraphed that all too much. And to the gentleman that you mentioned, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who is still very much a close ally of President Trump, said that if you call characters in like him, then we will call our own witnesses and it will go on and on for months. And again, that is something that, frankly, no one in the Senate wants. Even the defenders of the president want to move on from this. So the question of witnesses is a tricky one. The fact that that defendant volunteered himself is quite interesting, but it's hard to see a pathway to witnesses at this point. Certainly things could change.
You mentioned this pivot to the rest of Biden's agenda, because of course he doesn't want this trial to eat up too much in terms of like the nation's attention, in terms of the things that he wants to get done. And his top priority right now is that $1.9 trillion COVID-19 relief bill. We've seen that unemployment compensation is going to run out at the end of the month. And Democrats want this big relief bill passed quickly. They've even said that they'll push it through with or without Republicans at this point. And of course, Republicans are not happy about this. They're saying it's too much and they want to negotiate.
It would be very disappointing, Madam President, if Democrats decided to shove a partisan bill through Congress without even attempting to work with Republicans.
Now, on Friday, we heard that they might use a process known as budget reconciliation to get it through. And today, as we record this, Biden is meeting with the GOP to talk about their $618 billion plan. How might budget reconciliation work in this case?
So budget reconciliation, well, I'll try to do this without putting your listeners to sleep. It's a process that's been used by both parties in the Senate to pass bills that are primarily affecting the budget in some sort of way. So tax bills, spending bills, something that really does have an impact on the budget, and pass them without needing 60 votes in the Senate. So we know that nearly all bills need the support of at least 60 senators, most of the time a bipartisan majority. in the Senate, but on specific bills, you can get it through this process called reconciliation. And there is a very long process by which all the provisions in the bills are signed off and on and given a thumbs up or a thumbs down, whether they qualify for this reconciliation procedure. But some examples. So the final version of the Affordable Care Act back in 2010 was passed under reconciliation. And that is something that Democrats back in the first years of President Obama's term had to do because in a dramatic fashion, they lost the 60-vote majority they had in the Senate because former Senator Ted Kennedy passed away. That made it to 59 votes among Democrats. And then a Republican won in Massachusetts, which is a historically Democratic state. So Democrats used it to pass health care in 2010. And Republicans had tried to use it twice under the Trump presidency, once successfully and one not so successfully. First, they tried to use that same process to pass a repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but they could not pass because they couldn't even get 50 votes for it. Remember that famous John McCain thumbs down at the late hours of the night on the Senate floor in 2017. But Republicans also used that process to pass their major tax cut law at the end of 2017, and they passed that with party line votes. So it's a process that's existed for several decades, but in recent years, it's been a way to enact major changes that have an impact money-wise without needing support from those in the minority party.
Now, it's been interesting to me just how many executive orders President Biden has pushed through in the first few weeks. I've seen some graphics that compared the number that he pushed through to other presidents, and it's way, way more. So I'm interested in talking about this use of executive orders to push his top priorities. Let me start with his plans to advance racial equity. So he's passed through a bunch of executive orders on policing, education, health, and housing. He's talked about reforming the prison system, fighting xenophobia against Asian Americans. All of these have been done through executive order. What's your read on these plans? How were they received at Capitol Hill?
You know, it really depends on what party you are, because it is a tale as old as time that members of the opposing party of the president will decry executive overreach when they try to push priorities that they don't necessarily want. So, for example, Republicans have been really critical of President Biden's move to end the permitting for the Keystone Pipeline, which is a huge priority for Republicans. It is something that President Trump supported, but obviously President Biden reversed in his first days of office. We have major orders coming later this week on immigration, and I would expect that it would be praised by Democrats, by immigration advocates, but criticized by Republicans. And that's just kind of a tale as old as time, where Democrats were critical of the various executive orders that President Trump took during his presidency. And then back in President Obama's days, Republicans were critical of the actions that then President Obama was taking. So the Biden White House has justified it in two ways. They say there are pressing crises in the country, not just COVID relief and the economic fallout related to the pandemic, but on racial justice issues, on climate, on immigration, on national security, that the president has to act quickly in the first dozen days of his administration. But they also know that to make these changes last, to make it lasting, they do need the buy-in of Congress, and they need a lot of these things to pass legislatively. So for example, on immigration, President Biden had ordered his Department of Homeland Security to put a 100-day pause on deportations. Now that's being challenged in the courts, but an administration can try to pause deportations for undocumented immigrants who aren't the biggest threats to national security in the United States. Mm-hmm. But President Biden alone can't craft a pathway to citizenship for these immigrants. Only Congress can do that. So they're trying to be really ambitious, but try to work within the constraints of what they can do legally.
One that particularly caught my attention was his executive order related to healthcare. So part of the order he signed last week is to reopen the Affordable Care Act enrollment, also known as Obamacare. So that extends the ability to get healthcare coverage to millions of uninsured Americans. And like, look, this is, of course, something that Biden has championed for a long time. And there's a lot of language around these orders being a good start and a good first move. But just because you do it through executive order, doesn't that mean that there's a larger hill to climb after that?
There definitely is. So the issue with the Affordable Care Act is that the Trump administration had dramatically cut back kind of this enrollment period for the healthcare law. I mean, we heard so much about legislative attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but much less talked about were the Trump administration's sort of quieter attempts to kind of kill this law by a thousand cuts. So certainly shortening the enrollment period was one of them. And the Biden administration expanded that right away to give people who qualify more time to apply. They will employ more navigators to help people apply and help people sign up for healthcare. But that just means that certainly the Biden White House acknowledges that there is more to do on healthcare. And aside from combating the coronavirus pandemic, a healthcare overhaul isn't something that's necessarily part of the 100-day agenda for the Biden White House. But, you know, the Affordable Care Act, as much as it did expand healthcare, it still leaves millions of Americans uninsured. And that's why you saw that vigorous debate in the Democratic primary about, you know, Medicare for all versus expanding and shoring up the Affordable Care Act. We know Vice President Biden is in the latter camp. They can take steps by executive action to make the Affordable Care Act more accessible for those who qualify. But to get more people under, you know, healthcare, health insurance, that's will take legislation. And that's certainly a challenge. And it's certainly a challenge that we can expect to see in the coming months and years.
One of the criticisms I've heard frequently has been that executive orders have a harder time translating into substantial policy, that they really end up serving as some kind of direction to the base that says, this is my administration's sort of priorities. And like, look, as a Canadian, and I'm sure a lot of Canadians are listening to this conversation, they're thinking, why not just do everything by executive order? Why do the thing where you try to like wheel and deal and work with other parties in Congress? What are the limits of executive orders?
Just one fundamental principle is that the president of the United States is not a king. There really is a focus on not trying to make lasting changes. Obviously, most presidents would prefer that those lasting changes be bipartisan to make sure that these laws, these massive programs to help Americans are durable and they last for generations. And, you know, there are certainly limits legally on what a president can do on his own. And certainly opponents of a president's executive actions have repeatedly gone to court to challenge these executive actions. I mean, if you remember the travel ban that President Trump imposed on the first days of his presidency, where it blocked travel from, you know, several majority Muslim nations, you know, the first couple of iterations of that travel ban were blocked by the courts. And I think it was on the third try that they finally got the Supreme Court to sign off on it. So that's why you need the legislation to make it last, you know, to make it more durable. Mm-hmm. And that's what President Biden is trying to convey here.
Now, before I let you go, Sungmin, it's been about a dozen days since inauguration. What do these early days tell you about the kind of presidency that Joe Biden is looking to have?
So Joe Biden is looking to have a presidency that's just, it's not unlike what he faced during the Obama administration, where just immediately in the first months of an administration, you've inherited a crisis. So obviously, back in the Obama years, it was the economic crisis after the 2008 crash. And right now, it is the coronavirus pandemic and the economic fallout that has accompanied it. So it really is a test of how ambitious and fast and how big a president goes to deliver relief for millions upon millions of Americans who are hurting. And I think that a lot of Biden and his team, you know, obviously they're veterans of the Obama era, where in the first several weeks, the Obama administration tried courting Republicans to try to make it bipartisan, to try to compromise on their kind of main goal to get bipartisan support. And they really didn't get much at the end of the day in terms of economic relief. There were no House Republicans who supported it and only three Senate Republicans. So the Biden team is really aware of that. They're kind of betting on the fact that voters remember the results and not the process. I know we, and you know, in Washington, we get caught up on process, but voters don't often care about whether a bill gets 60 votes or whether senators have to use reconciliation to get there. They care about the checks in their bank account. They care that their unemployment insurance provides a safety net for them when they are looking for a job. And I think that's the calculation that the Biden team is making right now. It's a presidency that's facing a major challenge. It's a presidency that campaigned on this theme of unity, but it's a presidency that also knows that they have to get things done fast on so many fronts. And sometimes that doesn't always lend well to this kind of compromising, wheeling and dealing part of Washington that Joe Biden was so good at in his dozens of years in Washington.
Listen, Sungmin, that sounds like a very complicated start to a presidency, and I'm really grateful to have your insight in guiding us through this. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sungmin Kim is a White House reporter for The Washington Post and CNN political analyst. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll break down some of Biden's climate plans with BuzzFeed climate reporter Zara Hirji.
Queer life in Montreal was wild.
Montreal in the 90s was a great time, but it had a dark side.
It was not a safe city for gay people back then.
But what else was behind a series of deaths in the city?
Somebody's killing gay men. We want to know why.
I'm Francis Poord, and this is The Village, The Montreal Murders. Get early access to episodes at cbc.ca/listen or by subscribing to the CBC True Crime Premium channel on Apple Podcasts.
Okay, we are back from break, and we are here with BuzzFeed climate reporter Zara Hirji to talk about Biden's executive order announcement last week to address climate change. Zara, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you on. I'm so excited to talk to you about this world that you inhabit because you know everything there is to know about it. I honestly feel like your reporting is how I ground myself in most sort of climate change and climate policy news that I need. And so I'm just really grateful that you're on the show today.
Well, that's so nice. I always love to hear that.
Now, I want to talk to you about one story that you wrote last week. You wrote, it was sort of a big story about Biden's new climate policy. The headline for the piece was, Biden's latest executive orders are the most aggressive moves on climate change of any president. That is pretty significant. So Biden has already directed his administration to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. He pulled a key permit for the Keystone XL pipeline. He demanded a review of roughly 100 anti-environmental rules that Trump had introduced. Let's talk about all of this. I guess let's contextualize this because some of those executive orders went even further, and I want you to tell us all about that. Give us an overview of everything that Biden has done so far because it's been so much.
It has really been so much. It's kind of hard to emphasize just what a big deal these really early actions have been. So you already listed some of the things that Biden did on his very first day, but then last week he went a big step further.
In my view, we've already waited too long to deal with this climate crisis. We can't wait any longer. We see it with our own eyes.
In particular, he signed this executive order on tackling the climate crisis at home and abroad.
Okay.
There's really so much, but one of the big pieces is that it directs the Department of the Interior to pause new oil and gas leases on federal lands and public waters. Notably, it leaves all future leases on tribal lands alone. It also orders a review of all existing fossil fuel leases on public lands and federal waters, and really orders the U.S. to look for ways to boost renewable energy. Now, it's important to note that this isn't exactly the fracking ban that a lot of people have talked about, but it is a really big step towards that. Also, the president can't really do a federal fracking ban exactly, but does have control over federal lands, and this is a step towards that. Another key piece of this is it just creates a lot of different working groups and initiatives that will then pick apart specific pieces of the problem. So it creates a civilian climate corps initiative that will be devoted to creating new jobs and conservation. It creates an interagency working group on coal and power plant to look up how to develop projects that really cut pollution from these industries and support these industries as we kind of transition away from our reliance on fossil fuel. It creates environmental justice initiatives looking to boost enforcement and environmental justice. And then kind of transitioning to the foreign affairs side, one of the big steps that will be kind of coming in the next couple of months is we're going to host a leaders climate summit. Leaders can talk mm-hmm. about how to boost their own climate targets. And ahead of that, the U.S. will release its new target as part of the Paris Climate Agreement.
That is a lot to get done in a year, let alone 12 days, right? Like, that is quite a significant amount of moves. And I guess it's particularly aggressive when we look at it in the context of everything that Donald Trump had done when he was in office, which is why I've seen a few people saying, well, yeah, like, these moves are significant, but maybe we shouldn't be excited about them. Maybe we shouldn't call them too aggressive when a lot of them are just basically reversing the effect of Donald Trump.
They actually go much further than just undoing the Trump administration's efforts, which is why I think, you know, we had that headline and really do kind of see these actions as being pretty bold and aggressive. They don't just start to undo what Trump did. They don't just redo some of the things that Obama had done. They go a step further. And, you know, it's important to note that it's not like all of this is now done or will be achieved in Biden's next 100 days. Like, these are actions that may take his entire presidency to really fulfill, if not longer. You know, as part of the order, he's directing every federal agency to kind of create their own climate plan and then to carry that out. But it really does stand out compared to the past administration, which not only undid climate efforts by the previous administration, but really dug its head in the sand.
You mentioned this earlier. You said that one of the orders puts a pause on all new oil and gas leases on public lands and offshore waters. We have a rough idea that a total national ban on leasing could reduce carbon emissions by about 280 million tons a year. How much of that amount do public lands make up?
Yeah, so most drilling takes place on private land.
Yeah.
That being said, and I cite this in my story, that the fossil fuel extraction on public lands really did make up about a quarter of all U.S. emissions. So if you stopped all of it, that would be a really big deal. This isn't doing that. First of all, it doesn't touch coal, and it's saying we're pausing new leasing. But it's setting up the path towards potentially stopping more, since they say they're going to review existing leases, knowing that this one area is responsible for 25% of emissions, or at least was at one point. I mean, that's a big deal. The only way you're really going to cut emissions across the board is when you're addressing every little sector, every little piece. And so I don't want to minimize this move.
I think that's something that a lot of people are grappling with, is how to understand these moves in context of, like, how significant they are right now, but also how significant they are for the big picture, because the U.S. has been, as you mentioned before, slow on climate action for a few years. And so having any action whatsoever feels significant, but then it sort of becomes hard to gauge, like, what is a massive event and what is just, like, returning to normality.
Yes. And I think slow is maybe a really nice way of putting it. I think in many ways we've been running backwards at full speed.
Yeah.
But the leases on public lands is also a good example of one area where the administration didn't go as far as it could have. This new order does not pause new leases on coal on public lands. That is something I think a lot of people hope to see, expected to see. It's a little unclear why. Was this a nod to the West Virginia senator who is more moderate? Maybe. But it's certainly one area he could have gone and didn't. And in fact, early reporting suggested that the administration was considering it. And in the press conference announcing these moves, a reporter asked Gina McCarthy, the new kind of domestic climate czar, a position that was created under this administration, about this. And she didn't have a good answer for it. So I think that's one area to continue to watch, but does suggest that they aren't going as far as they potentially could.
Right. Let's talk about the people behind these policies, because you just mentioned a name, Gina McCarthy. She's leading the new White House Office of Domestic Climate Policy. We also have John Kerry. He has got a brand new title, a Special Presidential Envoy for Climate. There's Jennifer Granholm, who's nominated as Energy Secretary. What do these choices tell us about the president's ambitions on climate change?
Well, John Kerry is this huge figure. Now, he was the former Secretary of State. He was a presidential nominee.
Yes.
You know, one could argue that there really aren't more high-profile people to be working on this issue. So to kind of make him this new presidential envoy, which will mean that he is the face, the leader of all of our international talks and negotiations on climate change, whether that's with the Paris Climate Agreement or G7 or G20 summits. No, he is the top dog on this issue. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. A lot of our international allies and other countries know him because as the former Secretary of State, he worked on getting the Paris Climate Agreement over the finish line in the first place. So it is someone that has a lot of existing relationships around the world. It means that he isn't starting from zero. He is working off of all the relationships he has, his expertise, to push this issue forward.
The stakes on climate change just simply couldn't be any higher than they are right now. It is existential. We use that word too easily. And we throw it away. But we have a big agenda in front of us on a global basis.
Similarly, Gina McCarthy was Obama's EPA chief. It was under her lead that the EPA published the Clean Power Plan, you know, what many consider Obama's signature climate rule. Mm-hmm. And she is someone, because she's been so vocal, has rallied a lot of support across the environmental world. And I think that's another big piece of who he's selected, is he's selecting people that together really show he's taking into account what progressives care about on climate change, as well as more moderates in the party, you know, people across the environmental spectrum. So Gina's name, as well as the nomination of Deb Haaland for Interior Secretary, those are two people that the Sunrise Movement, the youth climate group, had been pushing for, versus, you know, other people that maybe have more of a support from industry or the core of the Democratic Party. And so I think he's showing that he's listening to different perspectives and wants to bring a bunch of people, especially a bunch of veterans from the Obama administration, on board to lead this effort.
Let's talk about symbolism. So last Monday night, before these executive orders were even released, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told Rachel Maddow on MSNBC that Biden should declare climate change a national emergency.
Then he can do many, many things under the emergency powers of the president that wouldn't have to go through, that he could do without legislation.
I want to get your take on this. Why is Schumer saying this now? And do you think this is something that the president is going to do?
I don't know if he is going to do it, but it is not a new idea. So back in 2019, President Trump had declared a national emergency over the erection of the South border wall. And at the time when he was first thinking about it, a lot of Democrats and Republicans said, well, this might open the door for a future Democratic president to declare a national emergency on climate change. Fast forward to today, and now we're having that conversation. It actually is more than just a symbolic move. And it's part of the reason why Trump did declare a national emergency for the border wall. He did it because Congress wasn't giving him the funds. And so by making that declaration, he was kind of able to access new tools, if you will, specifically getting money from the Pentagon budget to fund the border wall. And that was part of what Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has been arguing for, saying that by making this declaration, this could give Biden access to additional funding responding to this crisis. That means that he would be going around Congress to do it. Maybe one reason Schumer is saying this is because Democrats, while they have now a majority in the House and the Senate, it's a very slim majority, and they understand that there are some limitations with this. So it is perhaps a nod to say, well, if you're not able to get through in our budget negotiations the money you want, this is a tool that you have. Now, the Republicans, just we've been seeing this with the discussions over the current pandemic aid package. If Biden were to do that, it would kind of fly in the face of his rhetoric around unity. Mm. But Trump has already shown a path. His declaration as the national emergency for the border wall was challenged, and the Supreme Court upheld it. So I think it's certainly possible. But there's a big difference between declaring a national emergency for a very specific project and for a long-term ongoing crisis. We haven't really seen a declaration for something like that. And what could it actually mean? Mm-hmm. But it would be far more than just a symbolic move.
Yes, it becomes more than a symbolic thing because you're able to marshal a lot more resources. And then you have Biden, who appears to be following through on a bunch of other campaign promises, including hosting International Climate Summit. That's looking to be maybe held on Earth Day, April 22nd. We're hearing that John Kerry is saying that this summer he wants to make up for lost time over the last 4 years, and it certainly has been a significant amount of lost time and lost progress. And that brings us back to Paris. The U.S. is rejoining Paris. Tell us about some of the climate goals that they might be announcing leading up to this April summit.
It's really just one big goal. Every country that is a member of Paris has to make their own pledge for how they want to cut down emissions. Under Obama, the U.S. pledge was to cut national emissions by at least 26% by 2025 compared to 2005 mm-hmm. levels. There is a ton of expectation, and I think Biden's announcement last week reemphasizes that they are not just going to adopt that same pledge. They are going to come up with something bigger, bolder. And they specifically said, we'll hear what that new pledge is ahead of the summit, basically in time for the summit, because it will be part of the U.S. bargaining chip, saying, okay, here we are putting our new bold pledge out there as a way to encourage everyone else to boost their own pledges.
So there's going to be roadblocks to getting there, especially when it comes to getting climate policy passed through Congress. Do we have any idea of how the Democrats are going to work to try to get these plans through?
Not really. It's clear by Chuck Schumer kind of telling Biden so early that he should declare climate change a national emergency, that he is prepared to lead the Democrats in working on this issue, which as minority leader wasn't really an issue that he was driving. And so this is signaling a change that Congress is going to start working on this. One area that a lot of people have kind of been talking about in the lead up to Biden's taking over as president is, can the next big coronavirus aid package be one that includes a lot of climate initiatives baked into it? You know, as part of the money that is being doled out to businesses, can there be carve outs for the solar industry, for the wind industry, for clean energy, for example? And I think that's one area where this administration could really work with Congress to move forward on climate action, not as a standalone thing, but really couched in the response to the pandemic.
Well, that is a lot to get through. Zahra, I am excited to basically bookmark your author page and just return to it every day because there's going to be so much happening.
We'll see. But I'm always available to come and tell you more of what's happening and explain the news.
I really appreciate that and really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
That is it for this week. Sarah Hirji is a climate reporter at BuzzFeed News based out of Washington. Earlier on the show, we had Sungmin Kim, White House reporter for The Washington Post and CNN political analyst. Party in the USA is made by CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm your host, El Amin Abdul Mahmoud, and I will talk to you on Thursday on the regular version of Party Lines with Rosemary Barton. See you then.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.